On May 19th, 2023, actor Rick Dalton passed away peacefully in his home in Honolulu, Hawaii. He is survived by his wife, Francesca. Dalton was beloved by fans of Bounty Law, where he played bounty hunter Jake Cahill for 5 seasons, and also for his iconic role as Eddie Karpinski, the flamethrower-wielding vigilante in The Fireman Part 2, and The Fireman 3, CIA Crackdown. But he was so much more than that, with a career that spanned over 20 years. On this episode of the Video Archives podcast, we invite you to remember Rick Dalton. In part one of our memorial episode, we begin with a Q&A conducted by Quentin in 1999 between him and Rick. Then, we discuss his famous roles and some standout television performances in Cades County and Manhunter. My name is Gala Avery, and joining us now, here's Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery.
Last Friday, May 19th, Rick Dalton passed from this earth. He died with his wife, Francesca, in Honolulu, Hawaii. Let me bring my co-host into the show. This is Roger Avery sitting across from me.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
And Gala Avery.
Hi, I'm here early.
She is here early.
Well, it's a kind of a special day.
Yeah, exactly. So I got in touch with the guys, the Averys, and said I wanted to do this special episode. And then they came over. And then just the other day, we watched some of Rick's videos. Roger, did you grow up knowing who Rick Dalton was? Did you watch Bounty Law? Did you watch 14 Fist of McCluskey?
I've seen episodes of Bounty Law. Mm-hmm. I have seen it. It was before my time. I was young when Bounty Law was even in reruns. Mm-hmm. However, I do have one kind of major connection, I think, to Rick that mm-hmm. kind of helped shape me uh-huh. as to who I am, and actually brought it with me today.
Oh, uh-huh. What?
So I went to Art Center, College of Design in Pasadena, uh-huh. and there I studied cinema and studied editing. But this would have been basically anybody who went to film school in LA would have had the same assignment. We all basically had the same assignment. When you're learning editing, and in those days we edited on Moviolas, mm-hmm. and when we were learning editing, everybody did their Bounty Law. So like if you went to, LACC and you were in their film program,
yeah.
you would do your Bounty Law. Uh-huh. If you went to USC, you would do your Bounty Law. All those guys did their Bounty Laws. They would give you a scene from Bounty Law and you would cut it. And on a Moviola, on 16mm, black and white, like a dirty dupe.
Yeah.
As if they really cut Bounty Law back in the day.
Yeah.
Because they cut that on Moviolas. It's literally just one scene uh-huh. composed of 12 shots. Mm-hmm. And it was a shootout.
Yeah, so
there's like a shot of a barrel and a little stunt gag that happens to the barrel. Uh-huh. And there's a guy that falls off of a horse. And there's all this stuff that happens. Mm-hmm. And you're basically mm-hmm. meant to create tension with the scene and then to cut it together to create a kind of your own version.
And tell a story. Yeah, exactly.
And basically tell
how would
story.
You juggle the footage?
How would you juggle the footage? Are you going to try to milk it and keep it long? Mm-hmm. And, how are you going to like punctuate the footage? And so I cut mine and I brought it today. I actually have my can't see it's Roger Avery Art
yeah.
Center
uh-huh.
project just here on film. It's just black and white dupe.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I very early on kind of didn't make me get into the show, to be perfectly honest. It was literally like like eating glass to cut this uh-huh. thing because I had never used a Moviola before. But I learned how to use a Moviola literally doing
a Bounty Law.
My Bounty Law, my scene from Bounty Law. Yeah. What I learned was that you kind of like lean into the Moviola because it had a handbrake on it. And so, you're like running it and suddenly like Rick pulls his gun and you hit your brake at the right time. You emotionally cut.
Yeah.
And then you cut to the other guy and getting shot or whatever. It didn't make me like this big fan, but when he passed away and we said we were going to do this episode, the first thing I thought of was, oh, wow. Like I actually did
I've worked with Rick Dalton
in a weird kind of way.
So you didn't see like 14 Fist of McCluskey as a kid?
Well, no, I'd seen 14 Fist of McCluskey as a kid, but I liked the movie and it wasn't uh-huh. like I was like Rick Dalton. Like wasn't my big, the guy that I was really into. So that was like the good, early exposure to him. The second one is a little bit more dubious mm-hmm. because as you know, I was incarcerated for a while. And while I was there, at a certain point, I noticed that the branding for the mattresses, the bedding, the toothbrushes, the combs, the toiletries, the cleaning supplies, shower shoes, like all that stuff, mm-hmm. was made by a company called Rick Dalton Company Incorporated. And Rick had a company that made this shit, this like prison supply stuff, like prison uniforms and like jail blues and oranges. Yeah. And I was like, while I was there, I was like cursing his name, motherfucker, profiting. Like literally, like the little packets of ketchup had like, you know, Rick Dalton Company Incorporated written on them. I was like, what the fuck is this, man?
That would be like jail. It was like everything you have, like Bill Bixby Corporation presents.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm sure he invested in this company. I looked it up after I got out. It's based in North Carolina and with a distribution thing, I think, in Arizona somewhere. But like he...
Well, I'm glad Rick did well with his money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just one of the many investments he did. And it just was like, it pissed me off because literally I got like, you know, heat rashes and shit from those mattresses, those vinyl mattresses.
So Gala, how much did you know about Rick before this weekend?
Nothing as exciting as my dad, I'll tell you that. Rick Dalton is more of a face than he is a person to me, if that makes sense. Like I can recognize him on posters because, I mean, obviously you have a giant poster of him hanging in your living room and I stare at it when we watch movies.
Well, like, I think when we saw Nebraska Jim, because there was a time, Gala would just say, like, all old men look alike to her.
And old is a subjective term at this point in
my life. Yeah, so she'd be like, you know.
I've seen.
What you mean is. All handsome men of a certain era, that era, they all look alike.
They're kind of rugged. And
I mean, they're very handsome for sure. Yeah. I mean, I've seen a few of his movies. Like, I had seen Grizzly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I like Grizzly. Mm-hmm. His character's kind of like not the most memorable one to me, but I do like that movie. And then, of course, I've seen The Fireman.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm not a huge fan of The Fireman. Sorry.
I personally like Fireman Part 2.
Wow, that's the best one.
You have to call it Part 2.
Yeah. Chapter 2.
Well, because it begins like a second after.
No, it's like Rocky. It's like Rocky 2. Or
Halloween 2. I actually found an interview with Rick from Cine Fantastique.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it was the one with Paul Schrader and Nastassja Kinski.
I
it was around the time of Cat People.
I have that issue in my Cinema Fantastique.
And collection. The quote was,
yes.
Quote, I was originally gunning for a young director named Rick Rosenthal because I loved what he did with Halloween 2. But I got to say, we dodged a bullet with that one because Cliff was the obvious best choice. And boy, did he light it on fire or what? And so I think, so obviously Rick Dalton saw and loved Halloween 2.
Yes.
And that's why Donald Pleasance is in Fireman 2, I'm sure, also.
Yeah.
And I also heard that Rick had also wanted to be in, he wanted the Donald Moffat part in The Thing. He didn't get it.
Oh, wow. That would have been amazing.
And I think that would have been I love Donald Moffat.
Yeah.
He was my neighbor.
Yeah.
Think Rick Dalton would have brought something really cool to that.
I can't even imagine how awesome that would be. No, the thing is, like, in the case of, like, Fireman Part 2, so he'd made a deal with Canon Pictures to do a four-picture deal. And so they went through the trouble of going back to Avco Embassy and buying the Fireman franchise.
Oh, is that how that happened?
Yeah. They spent the money.
Well, that's when they were, like, flush.
No, absolutely.
I want to say American Ninja money, but it's probably before American Ninja.
Breaking money,
breaking, yeah.
And Chuck Norris money. They had all that stuff. You know, and all the Death Wish sequels are doing good. So they were, you know, that's when they were really flush with cash. And so they made a deal, a four-picture deal, but one of them had to be Fireman 2, maybe Fireman 3. We'll see what happens. But the thing about it was, that was back when Golan Globus like had a tremendous amount of money and were happy to throw it at things. So they were talking about Fireman Part 2 being a really, really big picture. And so then the best action director in Hollywood was Walter Hill. So they went to try to get Walter Hill to direct Fireman 2. And they offer him like more than he's ever been offered before, like $1.5 million. So much so that like he's forced to like consider it. So he gets together and has like lunch with Rick Dalton. And, Rick directed the first one. So Walter's like, well, why don't you just do the second one? He goes, I don't want to be a director. I want to, now that we have the money to do this the right way, you know, I want to be the best fireman I can possibly be. I'd like somebody, I don't care about being a director. I only directed the first one because no one's going to care about it enough. But now that we've actually got the money, you know, wanted to get a real director. So they didn't get Walter Hill. They offered it to Richard Fleischer, but he was just working with Dino at that time.
Yeah.
He was just doing one thing with Dino. They offered it to Richard Donner at Rick's.
Donner, you would think would have
Richard Donner was doing the biggest movies in Hollywood at that time.
Yeah, that's
he
true.
Can be lured to Cannon to do a sequel to The Fireman. But they did try to get Rick Rosenthal, who you're talking about. And they did even consider George Bowers, the guy who edited and directed Body and Soul, because they thought that was actually pretty good. But then, finally, Rick goes, well, look, if we're not going to get Richard Fleischer, and we're not going to get Walter Hill, and we're not going to get Richard Donner, then let's just let Cliff do it. I mean, it was like his action scenes and his fire scenes that made the first movie a hit anyway. And so I'll be there with the actors, and I'll be able to help him out as far as that's concerned. He can just do bigger, more elaborate action scenes. And that's exactly what they do in Fireman 2.
And that's why I like Fireman 2 better than The Fireman.
The one is
an origin story. And that's actually the inherent problem with the Fireman is that you have to spend all this time setting it all up and building his thing. And it's setting up.
Well, look,
it's like an origin story. You just jump right into it in Fireman 2, part 2.
You are right. Fireman 2, they kind of knew what they were doing by the time they did Fireman 2. And now they had the money to do it. And they had the canvas to do it. You know, I mean, the Fireman 1 is like $750,000. Fireman 2 is like a $4 million movie.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And it shows.
Yeah, and it shows.
Like he puts it all on screen.
It looks like a Walter Hill movie.
Yeah.
It looks like a cheapy Walter Hill movie.
Yeah.
Okay, but what it doesn't have, and it was a big part of the allure of the Fireman, is the sleazy New York milieu.
Yeah.
It's the best thing about the movie.
Yeah.
Is it captures that Times Square sleaziness just before it all got gentrified.
Yeah, the dirtiness
and Disney-fied. All right.
Yeah. So, before the Giuliani years came
in. It's little, you know, right along with Miss 45. It captures that New York sleazy vibe like to a T. So the whole move to Texas works. They make the move to Texas work. All the scenes of the Continental Club with the different Texas acts, that worked. Oh, but yeah, I do miss that New York milieu that the first film caught. But Jordan Baker's great in the fucking sequel.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, if there's one thing I like a little less from the Fireman Part 2, it's the heavy use of POV. I mean, that it's fine. I get it.
Uh-huh.
It's like, and that's in the time period. People are doing a lot of that.
Yes, it is.
But he overuses it a little.
He overuses it.
However, the action scenes, you just jump right in, and it's just like one scene after another. It's great.
Okay, so now we're getting to the films that we actually watched for the show. And so just for audience members out there, the whole idea is Rick Dalton became a star doing a late 50s, early 60s TV show called Bounty Law, where he played a bounty hunter. Like a lot of other young guys on television, he was very, very popular and started doing some movies during his time off and then kind of had his period where he could have a movie career. Same thing happened with Doug McClure. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened with Ed Burns, with George Maharis. And all those guys actually ended up doing quite a few different movies. Did they ever become a movie star? Not necessarily. Some guys did. James Garner did. Steve McQueen did. Clint Eastwood did. But most of the rest didn't. So that period of time was over. And then all of a sudden, you just saw, especially in the 70s, you saw Rick Dalton doing a lot of, like William Shatner, just guesting.
Yeah.
On a lot of people's show. He also had a thing that happened with him, though, in the late 60s, where like three hippies kind of bursting into his house, and they were tripping and they had a gun with them. And his his stunt double basically beat the brains in of two of them. And Rick set the other one on fire with the flamethrower from 14 Fist and McCluskey.
Well, I've heard about that.
Yeah. Actually, that's one of the great true crime LA stories that's out there.
Yeah, Gullah watches a lot of true crime.
I watch a lot of true crime. So yeah, that's one of them.
That became a thing, all right, because one, there's something kind of attractive about the star of Bounty Law come a couple of hippies that broke into his house. I'll make those, we'll teach those hippies. They sure picked the wrong fucking house to trip balls on.
Yeah, yeah, don't wander into Rick's backyard.
Well, those hippies picked the wrong house to trip fucking balls in that night. Anyway, so he got invited to like the Republican convention, all right, because he became this kind of like thing for the Nixon silent majority. Mm-hmm. And he's a lifelong Democrat, but like he went, all right, and they fucking dug him. So
it's a gig.
Rick was very happy being dug, all right.
Hey, that's my audience. Yeah. Part of my audience.
But they, you know, but they put him on Johnny Carson after that, and he was like a big hit on the Johnny Carson show. And then all of a sudden his TV shows, actually the because of the notoriety, he started doing better TV shows. He went from like doing Land of the Giants and Green Hornet to doing like Mission Impossible. And so one of the episodes that he got, which was one of his best episodes of the 70s, is this show called Cades County. That was Glenn Ford's TV show that brought him from movies to TV. This is one that I have the thing in the book. Okay, it's from the Herbie Gomez book.
The Man Who Would Be
Chapter Six, yeah.
The Man Who Would Be McQueen, that mm-hmm. book?
Yeah, and it's Rick Dalton in the 70s. This is me reading from it. Rick Dalton literally started off 1971 with a bang when he shot a rocket out of a bazooka into an armored car in an episode of Glenn Ford's new TV series. After appearing in mediocre movies for the last 4 years, Glenn Ford decided to make the move to television. Soon, a lot of big movie stars of the 50s and 60s would move to series TV. Rock Hudson with Macmillan and Wife, Anthony Quinn with The City, Richard Widmark with Madigan, Tony Curtis with The Persuaders and McCoy, George Papard with Banachek. But Ford was officially the first, and he did it with a damn good show called Cades County, which was a modern-day Western show where Ford played Sam Cade, a modern sheriff of a desert community called Madrid County. Where Madrid County was located, New Mexico, Arizona, California, was never clarified. The excitement of Glenn Ford headlining a TV series was the real deal. And the seasoned, charming man of action rose to the occasion. CBS put a lot of effort into bringing the movie star to the tube in style. The series had the best directors of the time, the best writers, and a gallery of big-name, high-priced guest stars, all playing colorful characters. Darren McGavin, William Shatner, Cameron Mitchell, George Maharis, and best of all, Rick Dalton. Dalton's episode, A Gun for Billy, is not only considered the best episode of this fondly remembered show, but it is also considered by many to be one of the best episodes of an action series of the 70s. It was one of those TV episodes that if you saw it when it aired, you never forgot it. Dalton played Billy Dobson, a man released from prison after serving 11 years. While serving time, Billy turned into a schizophrenic who thinks he's the Western outlaw Billy the Kid. The opening of the show gets my vote from most dynamic opening teaser of a dramatic TV series of the 70s, if not of all time, at least on Miami Vice. Billy, wearing period cowboy duds, crest on a horseback, singing to himself a little cowboy ditty. Oh, Lord, what a moaning. Oh, Lord, what a moaning. Oh, Lord, what a moaning when the sun begins to shine. He dismounts his steed and removes from the back of his saddle what appears to be a long rifle or a buffalo gun wrapped up in a blanket. Then the camera cuts behind him, and we see Billy's on the hill, looking down to a modern empty road with a lone armored car moving in his direction. As he continues to sing to himself, he unwraps the blanket, but we don't see its contents below frame. Then Billy rises to a standing position and raises the weapon, only it's not a rifle, it's a bazooka. Then he fires a rocket into the armored car, blowing a huge hole in its side and the damn thing right off the road. Then the outlaw mounts up and proceeds to rob the fallen armored car as if it were a stagecoach, and he rides off with $30,000. And this is such a good idea, I'm surprised no other writer has used it again or that nobody's tried it in real life. Billy's plan is to get his wife back, High Chaparral's Linda Cristal, kill the man and put him behind bars, Close Encounters' Warren J. Kimmerling, and pull off a daring train robbery. However, upon arriving at his former wife's house, who wants nothing to do with him, he realizes he has a son she never informed him about, none other than pre-Tiger Beat stardom Leif Garrett. So he snatches the boy and proceeds to live out the life of Billy the Kid, with Glenn Ford's Sam Cade hot on his trail. And by the time the two men meet in a Western showdown, this bonkers Billy the Kid thinks Sheriff Sam Cade is Sheriff Pat Garrett. I'm gonna get you, big casino. Billy Dobson is one of the best characters Dalton ever played and one of the best performances he ever gave. And A Gun for Billy is one of the best things he ever did. And Dalton agreed, telling me, the writer Tony Lawrence wrote a great character, and Dick Donner directed the heck out of it. That opening shot with the bazooka is one of the best shots of my career. According to Dalton, him and Ford didn't get along so well on Hellfire, Texas. But 5 years later, that was all water under the bridge. And when Dalton's name was brought up for the role, Ford agreed it was good casting. And not only that, doing the show with Glenn Ford made him a hero in the eyes of his wife, Francesca. She was positively thrilled to go out to dinner, the smokehouse, with the star of her favorite movie, Gilda, and the man who married her hero, Rita Hayworth. The episode was written by Anthony Lawrence, who also created the show for Planet of the Apes.
Mm.
One of the best episodic TV writers in the business, and Lawrence was so impressed with Rick's performance that years later he would write another great character for him on the Kurt Russell, Tim Matheson NBC Western show, The Quest. A Gun for Billy was directed by none other than Richard Donner 6 years before he'd do The Omen. Donner directed a lot of fun shows in the 60s and 70s, Man from U.N.C.L.E., Banyan, but before The Omen, A Gun for Billy was his best work. Rick was sensational on the show, and after having a bad reputation in the 60s, he started developing a good reputation in the 70s. So we watched that episode, A Gun for Billy, but like we talked about last episode with the Planet of the Apes movies, this was two episodes of Cates County, which I think the only thing they had in common was Richard Donner was the director.
Yeah,
yeah, and then they also just had that little interstitial scene that they made in between.
And then just kind of put together and released with a new opening credit sequence and everything called The Marshal of Madrid that was sold to TV syndicates. And also they did another one, another Cates County movie called Sam Cade. And that's the video that I have. You get both in like in the 9 hour mode, recorded in the 9 hour mode. We watched it, but we watched it either with a buzz running through it or the tracking off.
Yeah, it was one of, you had your choice. It was either that sound throughout the whole thing or like a kind of crazy.
So we listened to it with bad sound for like a while till we got sick of that. Then we watched it with bad picture for a while till we got sick of that. And we just kept
Just going back and forth.
We just kept going back and forth.
Tonight on the CBS Late Movie, danger in Cades County takes many forms. Glenn Ford stars in The Marshal of Madrid.
Beard!
Colony!
Beard!
The citizens of Madrid County sleep soundly thanks to Sheriff Sam Cade, until he meets his match in an oil magnate with a heart as black as tar.
You wouldn't shoot me, Sam.
Meanwhile, young Billy only thinks he's Billy the Kid, and he has his sights set on Cade. It all leads to a Texas Fried showdown.
We better let the sheriff handle this.
You move and I'll gut shoot you right where you stand, Chisholm.
With Rick Dalton and James Gregory, the Marshal of Madrid.
So what did you guys think of the Marshal of Madrid?
I love the Marshal of Madrid, actually. Yeah. I think it's great. And I actually think Rick is really good in it. I mean, he does a really good performance. Kind of a schizophrenic.
He's fucking awesome.
He's playing
in this.
A schizophrenic guy.
Yeah.
I think it. I totally agree with the book. I think it is one of his best performances, especially out of like what we've seen.
Yeah. Because
we watched like 5 or 6 of his movies, and I think it's one of his better performances, if not the best of the bunch.
Yeah, and
I think performance-wise, yes.
And the other Rick Donner, is doing an amazing job, and like he's totally banging it out.
Oh, we kept pointing out all the different shots that he's just killing it.
It's
with.
So efficient what Donner is able to do. How he will, you know, take a shot and just with a little tiny short piece of track, create like 4 perfect shots. You know, in between it, or that crane day that he has at the bridge,
at the train tracks over the bridge. That crane, there's like he does like all this crazy camera.
He's got a crane
so
for a day
great.
On a TV budget, and man, he breaks it out. And
well, he'd
uses
done a lot of TV
fullest.
By that time. He knew how to spend his time and spend it well.
And that bazooka scene in the beginning.
The bazooka scene is so great. I mean, that seems like the beginning of a Lethal Weapon movie.
Yeah, because I had never seen Cade County.
Yeah,
And so I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know that it was contemporary.
Yeah,
And so it starts off and, you know, it's like a Western. And I'm like, okay, it's like a Rick Dalton Western, right?
I'm watching
Rick in a Western. And he gets out and then next thing you know, he whips out a, you know, bazooka. And I'm like, what the
fuck is this? And there's a car.
Yeah, and there's a car on a road. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here?
It really sells.
There is one thing that I observed while watching this. Is that Rick and Glenn Ford are almost never in the same scene together. And even when they are in the same scene, you can tell they're two different shots. Like it almost looks like a different film stock being used for that close up of him in the window. And then the shot of Glenn Ford on the outside. Uh-huh. And there's a couple of clever uses of doubles going on there.
Yeah.
But it's almost like those two giants didn't have to cross their wires, and Rick could literally be treated like a star by Donner.
Absolutely.
He was there.
No, on the Rick Dalton days, it was all about Rick Dalton, you know, and on the Glenn Ford days, it was all about Glenn.
And he's great with Leif Garrett.
The chemistry with Leif Garrett is so good.
It's really, really good. No, they play great together.
That kid was so good. I didn't even know if it was Leif Garrett. Even though I knew Leif Garrett was in the show, I'd forgotten. Once we started,
you are disrespectful to Leif Garrett. I love
I don't mean to be disrespectful to Leif Garrett. I actually love.
He was in Tiger Beat in Devil Times Five. He's magnificent in Times Five.
Leif Garrett is great. Uh-huh. It's just that when I was growing up, he was my competition on the cover of every teen magazine.
I'm not
Leif Garrett. I'm like the other kind of kid.
I think that the main actress in this is Linda Crystal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think her chemistry with Rick is really, really good on screen because they're playing like a husband and wife, and he's been away for a while, and he discovers that he has this son. And when they're on screen together, it's like really tortured. Yeah. And they have really good chemistry as like this couple that's been pulled apart by his schizophrenia.
Yeah, you see all the terrible time that she had with him, all right, just by the look on her face.
Yeah. And really I love how happy. They dial in like the kind of piano music from the bar or whatever.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a neat thing.
A great like thing that happens.
It's a neat bit.
And he helps sell it because he's got a different look in his eyes in this movie than he has normally. Like
he's playing a fucking nut.
Yeah, he's playing a crazy guy.
And he keeps trying to like instigate these Westworld kind of like gunfights.
Yeah.
And so when he goes in there and he starts doing his Billy the Kid shit with this Westworld kind of thing going on, then all of a sudden he starts hearing the sounds of the Old West. He hears the sounds of a saloon or of a piano or the blacksmith, working on
The blacksmith.
The sounds of the horses coming into town.
When the blacksmith thing happened, I actually looked at my dad and I was like, is he just like at Knott's Berry Farm? I thought he was hiding out like at the theme park. Like, are there horses and stuff? Like, are they just hiding in this building?
They might have shot that at the haunted shack at Knott's Berry Farm because that's what it looked
like. Knott's Berry Farm is Gala's favorite.
I love Knott's Berry Farm.
Favorite amusement park.
There is a weird VHS thing. If you look up the Marshall of Madrid VHS on eBay, you'll get like an individual tape of the Marshall of Madrid. But then when you read the back of the box, it's not the story.
Oh, really?
It's not the correct tape. And so you have to get the two movie version, which they do sell. And it doesn't look exactly like the box.
Do you think they're selling Sam Cade? You think it's the Sam Cade movie?
I don't know if it's the Sam Cade movie.
Yeah, maybe that's the one they're
You know what? I think it is the Sam Cade movie, but they're calling it Marshall of Madrid the single box. And so it's a little bit confusing. So if you want the Marshall of Madrid tape, make sure to get the two movie set.
Ah, the internet just fucks everything up.
And I got mine for $9.99 on eBay.
Bounty Law, starring Rick Dalton.
Okay, I'm going to read again from Herbie Gomez's book, and this is on the chapter on his TV series Bounty Law.
Right.
Rick Dalton would get Bounty Law in 1959, but it would be a guest shot he did as Jesse James on Tales of Wells Fargo that caught the eye of executives at Screen Gems, the TV arm of Columbia Pictures, that paved the way for his own series. He was brought in for a proposed Western series called Bounty Law, playing a bounty hunter named Jake Cahill. While Screen Gems was hot for the laconic Missouri boy, they didn't just give him the role. He had to test for it, and as Rick told me, I better be fucking good. Dalton not only nailed the audition, but he also nailed the wardrobe test, the horse riding test, and the handling a pistol test. Ever since Rick was a little boy, he watched Westerns. And when he watched Westerns, he imagined being in those Westerns. He imagined himself riding horses, shooting guns, wearing cowboy hats, and beating the tar out of owl hoots. And now, only 5 years after hitting the town, he was the star of his own cowboy show. Lash LaRue, Dalton's boyhood hero, would be proud. Rick was also clever enough to realize Bounty Law wasn't just some run-of-the-mill TV Western. While at that time, there seemed to be a never-ending line of cowboys parading across the tube, Bounty Law was different. The big difference being his character Jake Cahill wasn't a sheriff, or a marshal, or a Texas Ranger, or a drifting gunslinger. He was a bounty hunter. Up until that time, when a bounty hunter showed up in a story, be it a movie or a TV show, they were usually portrayed as shady villains. But the television season before, from 58 to 59, Four Star Productions had launched a CBS show about a bounty hunter called Wanted Dead or Alive. The CBS series starred another sexy, slim young actor named Steve McQueen, playing a bounty hunter named Josh Randall. McQueen's program proved a change of pace from the standard cowboy show on TV, and his success was immediate. So Bounty Law was Screen Gems and NBC's attempt to jump on this bounty hunter bandwagon. Both Screen Gems and NBC saw Rick Dalton as a cross between Steve McQueen over on CBS and Ty Harden, star of Bronco, over on ABC. The biggest difference between Jake Cahill and McQueen's Josh Randall and Ty Harden's Bronco Lane was the producers allowed Dalton's bounty hunter to be a bit more morally questionable. Jake Cahill was still presented as the sort of good guy, if given the chance he'd rather take them in alive than dead, but his character veered closer to anti-hero status than any other Western show lead on TV at the time, and the anti-hero, slightly shady gunslinger was Dalton's favorite Western archetype. Burt Lancaster's smiling, laughing, black-clad bastard in Vera Cruz. Richard Widmark's bloodthirsty Comanche Todd in The Last Wagon. If given a choice between playing Wyatt Earp or Doc Holliday, Dalton would always choose Doc. Except these characters didn't star on TV shows. That week's guest star usually had those qualities, but not the series lead. But Jake Cahill possessed qualities that steered him closer to that type of characterization than the Lone Ranger straight arrow type that Clayton Moore and Chuck Connor specialized in. Screen Gems and the network NBC were hot enough on the series to launch it as a backdoor pilot on their popular series The Restless Gun, starring John Payne in an episode titled Epitaph for a Bounty Killer. But Bounty Law had another unique aspect when compared to the other Western shows on television. Most Western series starred two or even three cowboy leads on their show. And even when the owner only had one lead, he usually was backed by a cast of supporting characters. Bounty Law was different. It had no funny sidekick, no folksy old sheriff friend, no apple-cheeked school marm who's sweet on Jake. Just every week, Rick Dalton and that week's guest star, who was usually his antagonist. And Screen Gems provided Dalton a bevy of heavyweight, tough guy familiar faces, all with bounties on their head to collect. James Coburn, Charles Bronson, Vic Morrow, Robert Blake, and Claude Akins. Even former movie stars like Edward G. Robinson, Louis Hayward, and Douglas Fairbanks Jr., as well as current movie stars like Sammy Davis Jr., Ralph Meeker, Aldo Ray, Howard Duff, Darren McGavin, and Rory Calhoun. A lot of episodes consisted of Jake tracking down some murderous varmint or coming into a town and having to deduce who, among a bunch of suspects, was the man, or sometimes woman, he was looking for. The two most popular storylines on the show had Jake having captured a dangerous, crafty, desperate outlaw, having to get his prisoner to the hangman's noose without getting killed himself. Bronson, Coburn, Morrow, Lee Van Cleef, and Claude Akins all guest starred in tasty examples of this story. Or the storyline's opposite number. Jake has captured a fellow wanted for murder and is bringing him back to hang, but during the journey, but comes to feel that the man is innocent. So once they get to town, it's up to Jake to find the real murderer before his prisoner's hung. Robert Blake, Andrew Prine, Tom Laughlin, all guest starred in entertaining variations of this plot. I would like to read part one of a Q&A that I conducted with Rick Dalton back in 1999 at the Hawaii International Film Festival. So this is me asking questions to Rick privately ourselves. Some alcohol was involved, some reefer was involved. But we got down to brass tacks in 1999, actually in his backyard of his ranch house that he had in Honolulu. This is me. First off, Rick, thanks for sitting down and reminiscing with me about your career. Well, me remembering, that's the hard part. My memory ain't what it used to be, and that was never nothing to brag about. But as I always told my directors, I'll do my best. Well, let's start off at the beginning. Oh boy, here we go. So your first feature roles were guesting on the TV series Tombstone Territory? Yes, it was. That was a good show, and it was pretty popular, so it was a big deal to land a featured part on it. Frankly, Quint, I was probably never more excited in my life. I was playing a cowboy. I had a cowboy outfit, a hat, a gun, a holster. I got to show off my fast draw. I start the show riding into town on a horse. Now later, I'd start every episode of my series riding into town on a fucking horse. But that first time, with the cameras rolling, whoa, baby. I was playing a real part. A character with a fucking name. I'll never forget it. Billy Clanton. Up until then, I was just like reporter number 4, seaman number 3, radio operator number 1. And my character was critical to the story. The first time that happens, it's thrilling. But your next TV part, in one way, would be a step down. You're not a character with a name. You're a street gang member number 4. But in another way, it was a step up because you're acting in a scene opposite Betty Davis, Lee Marvin, and Robert Blake in Lee Marvin's cop drama, M Squad. Yeah. I played the 4th featured member of a black leather jacket street gang called the High Rollers. We're running a protection racket, and Miss Davis is the owner of a neighborhood candy store that refuses to pay. The High Rollers were James Darren as the leader, Sonny, Bobby Blake as second lieutenant, Buzz. The 3rd guy was Ross Bagdasarian, who later changed his name to Dave Seville and created the cartoon characters the Chipmunks. And I was High Roller number 4. I had 3 lines in that show, and one of them was, run! But I wasn't going to pass up an opportunity to act opposite Betty Davis and Lee Marvin. And when it come to Miss Davis, I was not disappointed. So we're doing this scene in Miss Davis's candy store, and the High Rollers come in and try to shake her down. Jimmy Darren's the leader. He has the most lines. Bobby Blake has a few lines. Bagdasarian has a couple lines. I have 1 fucking line. You tell her, Sonny. But regardless of the fucking lines, I had 1 agenda. I was going to get as close to Betty Davis as I possibly could, or they'd let me. So when we did the rehearsal, I make my move and got right next to her. The rehearsal's over. I'm fucking positive the director's going to tell me, what the fuck you think you're doing, kid? Get your ass there behind Bagdasarian. And if he knew Bagdasarian's name, that's exactly what he would have said. But Miss Davis sees me, and she knows exactly what this punk kid young actor is doing. She fucking loves it. And she tells this TV hack, no, I like the kid here. He's threatening. He's giving me something to work off of. I want him to stay. Bobby Blake's jaw hits the floor. He can't believe what he's hearing. The director tells Miss Davis, but he can't stand there. And she says, why not? And he says, because he's blocking your light. And she says, move the fucking light. And she says, fucking. And you know what they did? They moved the fucking light. Bobby Blake wanted to wring my neck. He's thinking that could just as easily be me standing next to Betty Davis. And while they're moving the light, Miss Davis looks at me, gives me a little smile, and with the 4 fingertips of her right hand, touches the back of my hand and tells me, well done. You know, half the glory of having a Hollywood career is having good Hollywood stories to tell. And I never get tired of telling that one with Miss Davis, especially to young actors. And I asked, well, you mentioned you worked with Robert Blake back then. You also acted with him on one of my favorite Berettas. Were the 2 of you friends? On and off. When I first met Bobby, I wasn't starstruck like I was when I met James Cagney. But I was sure impressed. You see, I grew up at a time when you were a kid on the weekends. Your parents dropped you off at the local movie house and you watched the Cowboys for a nickel. That's what we called it. We didn't say we were going to the movies. We said we were going to go see the Cowboys. And my absolute favorite was Lash LaRue. But I also liked the Cisco Kid, no matter who played him. I liked Buck Jones because he looked like he'd fuck you up. And I like Ken Maynard, but I dug his brother Kermit Maynard even more because Kermit played a Mountie, and for whatever reason, I always dug the red uniform of the Canadian Mounties. But what I hated about the Cowboys was their goofy fucking sidekicks. I mean, if these guys were so cool, why did they hang around these fucking idiots? Smiley Burnett? Guy was a fucking spaz. They're all a bunch of fucking losers. It didn't make any sense. If you're going to get in as much trouble as these cowboys did, why have a fucking ineffectual idiot as your sidekick? I mean, at least have somebody who can help out in a fucking fist fight. Well, there was one sidekick who wasn't a loser or an idiot, who wasn't a useless waste of space, and was right in there pitching when the going got tough. One sidekick who saved the cowboy more times than the cowboy saved him. And best of all, for us little kids, he was a little kid, like us. Red Ryder's sidekick, Little Beaver. We all thought Little Beaver was as cool as it was possible for a kid to be. And when Bobby was little, he played Little Beaver. And when I was little, I even knew Bobby Blake's name. That's how much I dug Little Beaver. So now, my first year and a half in Hollywood, and I'm doing a scene with the cat that played Little Beaver and Betty Davis and Lee Marvin? Now, that was a great letter back home to my folks day. I told them, tell everybody I grew up with. And then me and Bobby become friendly? We go out and get a beer together after work? Yeah, to me, that was making it in Hollywood. Are you fellas still friends? I love Bobby. I mean, we haven't seen each other since I moved to Hawaii, but that doesn't mean shit. That's how real friends are. I'll love Bobby till the day I die. He got me on a Beretta, and not just any Beretta, but a good one with a really good role. And he got me an episode of his show Helltown, at my full rate, too. Hell of a good cat. Great actor, too. He's the one who should have been a fucking movie star. The no-shit power of that guy? And Bobby wasn't Hollywood tough. He was badass motherfucker tough. Well, I know what you mean, but describe Hollywood tough. The rest of us punch some guy in a restaurant, they break it up in a minute, and we talk about it for the rest of our lives. Bobby will knock your front teeth out and bust your jaw on a busy street corner across the street from the fucking police station. Well, somebody else you worked a lot with back in the early days, and even in one of your last movies, was Charles Bronson. Now, I dated Charlie Bronson's daughter, Katrina, for a little bit. So I met him once when she invited me over to have dinner at his house, and he was really nice, but he was a really old dude back then. I heard back in his day he was famous for being prickly. Prickly. Does that mean prick? Well, not exactly, but it does suggest he was hard to get along with. How did you get along with Charlie? A little better than most. Not as good as some. The thing about Charlie is you were always going to do more talking with him during whatever scene you two were doing than sitting around on the set shooting the breeze in between takes. And that's even in movies where Charlie was playing an Indian. Some people thought he was an asshole, and he could be an asshole. But if you didn't judge Charlie for being Charlie, you could get along with him, and he'd appreciate it. But there were two Charles Bronsons. I knew him at first when he was with his first wife, Harriet. In those days, you could actually go out to dinner with him. Not often, but every once in a while. You know, he takes Harriet. In my case, I took whoever I was screwing on location. We did that a couple of times on Comanche Uprising. But after he married Jill Ireland, you can fucking forget that shit. He didn't want any fucking guy anywhere near her. He stole her from David McCullum, and he was going to make goddamn sure nobody stole her from him. Back then, I thought his territorial guard dog bullshit about his wife was fucking nuts. But since then, being married to a beautiful woman these last 20 years, maybe Charlie knew what he needed to do, and he didn't give a fuck what anybody else thought. So you got your start in features with one of my favorite directors, William Whitney. Wild Bill Whitney. Hell yeah. In my opinion, William Whitney is one of the most underrated action directors in the history of Hollywood. I believe you are correct, sir. Now, there isn't that much critical writing out there about William Whitney, but I did find an issue of Films in Review from 1974 that had a piece on Whitney. And the piece starts, "What Hitchcock is to the suspense film, Lubitsch is to sophisticated comedy, and Ford is to the epic Western, William Whitney is to the action film." No doubt about that. Glad to hear Bill getting some recognition. He deserves more. So your first feature role was for Whitney.
Yep.
A Strange Adventure. Starred Ben Cooper, who along with John Derrick was the leading juvenile star at Republic Pictures. Bill did about five flicks with Cooper. It was a Desperate Hours, Petrified Forest kind of thing. You know, three crooks on the lam, Jan Merlin, Maria English, Nick Adams. Take some innocent people hostage. In this case, a young hot rod racer played by Cooper and a brother and sister played by me and Joan Evans. Now, I was pretty excited to get this because, you know, before this, I'd only done little bit parts and features. You know, no character with a name. This was my first name in a movie. Luther Donegan. Now, the part I got wasn't the one I wanted. I wanted the Nick Adams bad guy punk part. I'm going to be one of the gangsters. But back then, you could practically call that the Nick Adams part. So naturally, Nick Adams got it. So I got the part of the dickless hostage brother. Nevertheless, I was thrilled to have this big a part in a real Hollywood movie, even if the guy was a wimp. But the best part was the way Bill, Whitney, and I vibed. And at one point, Bill comes up to me and says, look, I know you're kind of playing the dickless wonder in this, but you're doing a good job. I appreciate it. And hang in there. Coming up, I'll find something else for you. It'll be better suited to your talents. So he brings me in for a couple of things in public that don't pan out. Straight man, love interest to Judy Canova in one of her cornpone comedies. Jesus. Can you imagine doing your first kissing scene in a picture with Judy fucking Canova? Well, actually, when I was a kid, I kind of had a crush on Judy Canova. Well, as they say, Quentin, to each his own. So anyway, just before Republic goes belly up, they make a series of cheapy juvenile delinquent pictures. And Bill brings me in for one of them called Young and Wild. I don't get it. Scott Marlowe does. Then Bill brings me in for another one called Juvenile Jungle. I don't get it. Corey Allen does. Then he brings me in for Drag Race No Stop. That one I get. But Ben Cooper, John Derek, and Scott Marlowe have to turn it down before they let me have it. But Bill, true blue fucking cat that he is, was pushing for me all the way with the suits and that fuck Herbert J. Yates. So listen, 5 years after I hit town, Bill Whitney makes me a leading man. See, that's a debt you can't repay. I think Drag Race No Stop is a sweet little picture. It's a little uneventful. I win the big race. Yeah, like you didn't see that coming. But for my first lead, it wasn't bad. What you call uneventful, I call defying conventions. It's a drag race movie, and I win the race at the end. How is that defying conventions? Okay, yes, you win the race at the end, but everything else is so low-key. It's practically anti-genre. They don't try to kill you. The sheriff doesn't railroad you into a chain gang. They don't try to frame you for somebody's murder. Nobody gets killed in a car crash. What are you talking about? Big Joe totally fucks up my car. Well, not like they could have. I mean, they don't fuck up the engine. They just bust some glass and mess up your paint job. What? I should thank him for that? But it's nothing Ruby can't fix. You're still able to run the big race. Of course I'm going to run the big race. It's a fucking race car movie. I was just surprised, especially considering the genre, its lack of melodramatic elements. I mean, it reminds me a bit of a 70s Jonathan Demme film. Who's that? He's the guy who did Silence of the Lambs. You thought it was like Silence of the Lambs? No, I didn't think it was like Silence of the Lambs. But before he did Silence of the Lambs in the 70s, he did these humanistic little comedies that explored different aspects of Americana, Citizens Band and Melvin and Howard. Their identifying trait is their humanity. Like Drag Race No Stop, they have a gentle quality to them. Citizens Band? You mean like CB Radio? Yes, the film was about the CB craze in the 70s. Who's in it? The guy from American Graffiti, Paul Lamont. In fact, actually, he's the star of both of them. Never saw him. Well, I really liked the actress who played Ruby, Sheila Carroll. She's also in Monty Hellman's Beasts of the Haunted Cave. Do you remember her? Of course I remember her. We had a little thing together. Yeah, she was a real sexy something-something. I always thought she was kind of a barfly Veronica Lake. Yeah, a garbage pail Veronica Lake. Yeah, that's a good way to describe her. She only did a few movies. Yours, Beast from the Haunted Cave, Ski Troop Attack, something else. And then she disappeared. Do you know what happened to her? Oh, fuck if I know. And you work with Bridget Masters, who's another William Whitney regular. She's in that episode of Bounty Law that he directed that's like a remake of Stagecoach. Did you think it was weird that even though she's the love interest, you two never even kissed in the movie? Only on screen, brother. Off screen, we did a hell of a lot more than kiss. Like, there was a lot of cute girls on that flick. Me and John Ashley, we fucked them all. When it came to that part of Mag Wheeler, it came down to me and Robert Conrad. Bill liked us both. He ended up directing the pilot episode of The Wild Wild West. We were both good-looking, handsome, arrogant, cocky guys. So we were up for a lot of the same parts in the early days. I got this one. He got Pretty Boy Floyd and Young Dillinger. Bill ended up choosing me over Bob for three reasons. One, I was better looking. Two, I was taller. It wasn't hard to be taller than Bob Conrad. And three, I had a better pompadour. What did you think of Bob Conrad? Oh, Bob was okay. He's a guy you hear a lot of stories about. Some of them probably true. But the thing about Bob is he was short. And he fucking hated how short he was. And because he was a little guy, he had a hard-on for the world. You heard of that expression, Napoleonic complex? Well, Napoleon had nothing on Robert fucking Conrad. Somebody once said God made people short, least they rule the world. Well, whoever said that was talking about Bob Conrad. But Quint, it was different back then. Guys like myself and Bob worked a lot, and we worked with a lot of people. And you can't like everybody. And if Bob rubbed you the wrong way and he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, you probably hated his fucking guts. And sometimes he was right, and sometimes he was wrong, and sometimes he was out of line, and sometimes I'm sure he was a monster. But sometimes I was right, and sometimes I was wrong, and sometimes I was out of line, and sometimes I was a monster. That happens when you work as hard and as long as we did with as many people as we did. But the cats who dug him, John Ashley, Nick Adams, Don Stroud, they fucking loved the guy. Bill Whitney loved him. I'll tell you this about Bob. I always respected him. Bob had one of the most successful careers anybody's ever had in television. He starred in as many TV series as anybody's ever starred in, and every fucking series, Bob was in charge. On a Bob Conrad show, the only person you had to please was Bob Conrad. What do you think of him as an actor? Well, he basically played the same part, a cocky motherfucker. But if you're casting a cocky motherfucker, you ain't going to do better than Bob Conrad. He played Nick Carter once, and I'm a big Nick Carter fan. I've read a bunch of the Nick Carter books. But he was fantastic. He was a good Nick Carter, probably the best. But where Bob was fantastic was in Centennial. As the French fur trapper, Pascanel, fucking fantastic. They wanted Bobby Blake for that part. He turned it down, and they gave it to Bob. Bobby told me for the rest of his life, whenever Bob saw Bobby, he always said, thank you, thank you, thank you for turning that down, because of you turning it down, I got the best role I ever had. Nobody on TV could have done that role better than Bob. Going back to William Whitney, you starred in his second-to-last feature, I Escaped from Devil's Island, with Jim Brown. Now, I think my best theatrical film of the 70s. But in the Films and Review piece, it suggests Whitney didn't care for it. He described it as a sickeningly brutal movie. I Escaped from Devil's Island was released in 1973. Bill first started directing at the end of the Depression. It was a generational divide. Okay, for instance, none of these old-timers, Whitney, Ford, Hawks, understood Peckinpah. They didn't understand the blood, the nudity, the foul language, because they didn't want to understand. Because it was part of the world they spent three decades making movies in. But the truth is, Bill was a master of shooting violence. But he didn't consider what he shot violence. Violence is what Sam Peckinpah did, what Don Siegel did. Bill would say he shot action. But in movies, action is just a euphemism for violence. The climax of his Roy Rogers pictures are fucking violent as hell. And those movies weren't rated R. They were made for kids on the Saturday matinee circuit. All I'm saying is he was an old dude and he didn't get it. But that was a tough picture for Bill. His wife Maxine died back home while we were on location in Mexico. It meant in the late 30s. She was an actress in one of his serials. It was good he had a couple of old friends around, like Jan Merlin and myself. So you did your first William Whitney film with Jan Merlin, and 30 years later, your last film with Whitney was with Jan Merlin. Yep. Terrific actor. And it was on that picture that you met Jim Brown. Oh, I met him a couple times before that at parties and shit, but you know, I didn't know him until I did the picture with him. What do you think of Jim Brown? I love him. Straight up solid cat. The single straightest shooter I ever worked with, and one of the straightest shooters I ever met. If Jim Brown said the sky was brown, then I guess the sky must have turned brown because Jim just said it. And if you asked Jim to be somewhere, like be at some event at 4, if Jim said yes, you damn well better be there Sunday at 4, because if Jim said yes, he will be there. Of all the actors I ever worked with, Jim was the one I approached to star with me when I directed my first movie. And when Jim said yes, God bless him, that's when we knew we were going to get a movie made. Also, when I was writing the script about police brutality and corruption in inner city New York City, I took Jim out to lunch and asked him what he knew about it. He told me so much, most of which made its way into the movie. I wanted to make Jim a producer. He refused. He said, this is your thing. It'll be looked at differently if it's our thing. One, if it's our thing, I want to play the fireman and you play the fucking cop. But his point was, he wants the world to know that this was my thing, and he was working for me. By refusing a producer credit at that stage, he said goodbye to a bunch of money when we became a hit. Not only did Jim not give a damn, he was also happy for me. As I said, try fucking shooter. So that is part one of my Q&A with Rick Dalton. We'll go back for part two and maybe even part three and part four as the show goes on. But for right now, so you were talking about, Roger, you were talking about like you had a favorite Bounty Law episode?
Well, yeah, you know, I have seen Bounty Law. Uh-huh. And like I've seen a number of episodes, actually. But in preparation for this, I went through and I just wanted to, you know, catch up and watch a few. And one jumped out at me that was from the fourth season. I think it's from the fourth season. Uh-huh. And I think it's pretty late in the fourth season also. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to watch it is because it guest starred Ross Martin.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I love Ross Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
He was in
Artemis Gordon.
Yeah, Artemis Gordon from Wild Wild West. And my mom was Ross Martin's physical therapist. And so as a boy, I knew Ross Martin a little bit. Uh-huh. And so I've always been a huge Ross Martin fan. Like whatever he's in. And so when I saw that he had done a Bounty Law, I was like, oh, I want to mm-hmm. check that one out. And so Gala found it for me and I watch it. And it's called Incident with the Photographer Who Killed His Wife's Lover. And it's actually kind of a cool episode because Ross Martin plays Edward Muybridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
The guy who
Filmed like horses.
Yeah. And what happens in the episode is a representative for Leland Stanford, who was like at that time, the richest man west of the Mississippi, basically goes to Rick to get him to find and bring Edward Muybridge back to California before the other bounty hunters can get him. Mm-hmm. He's killed his wife's lover and then gone on the run. And Stanford, in the meantime, is trying to solve this puzzle that he's got. And it plays throughout the episode. They talk about it. Mm-hmm. Where do a horse's feet all touch the ground at the same time? Uh-huh. Or, you know, or is there ever a moment where the horse's feet are completely off the ground? And so Edward Muybridge had been hired by Stanford because he was a photographer of big vistas and everything like that. And he was hired to go to Palo Alto, which was a horse ranch at that time, to experiment with this. And so he developed this photographic technique of taking a picture of the horse as it was running. And then he developed a machine that would then put it all together. And we had an early version of motion pictures.
Yeah.
Even before the Lumiere brothers. Uh-huh. And there's actually a little bit of an argument. I've had arguments with Terry Fermeau about who invented cinema. Yeah, and he's like, well, Lumiere brothers. And I'm like, motherfucker, what about Edward Muybridge of California?
Yeah, yeah, right.
And so in this episode, he and Ross Martin and Edward Muybridge is like this kind of, I don't want to call him a hippie, but he's like a hermit kind of looking guy. Like, he, you know, despite the fact that he's like a respected photographer, he dresses in like these dirty clothes and has long hair. Mm-hmm. And he's like this kind of crazy, semi-crazy character. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is Stanford has set him up while he's developing this camera technique. Uh-huh. And the guy discovered that his wife was sleeping with another man and he killed him and then had to go on the run. And Stanford's like, well, I got to finish my thing. I got to know this because it was a bet he had with some other billionaire or millionaire at the time. And so Rick is the one who gets him and brings him back. And it's mostly the two of these guys, you know, as they're.
Well, that sounds like most Bounty Law episodes.
Yeah, it's like the two of these guys and they're on the run and they have like a couple of little encounters. And, you know, it's a great episode. It's really an interesting episode. And I love how it touches on real history.
Oh, no, I love how it touches on real history. Most good Bounty Law episodes are like Rick and like a really good guest star because it's usually just them.
Yeah. And it was like a different kind of guest star because he's not trying to take him to be executed. He's trying to take him back to avoid prosecution.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And
so
it's kind of and it was like an interesting twist on the kind of.
It's like a moral twist also.
It's a moral twist. And there's a bunch of, and they talk about that. I really like that.
Did you watch any of the episodes?
I watched that one with my dad, which I really enjoyed, but we only watched that one. I've seen like every now and then because my dad on our hard drive has like a bunch bunch of random TV episodes, like all misfiled.
Yeah, it's all
and
misfiled.
So every now and then, like I'll catch a Bounty Law episode. Mm-hmm. I think they're fun. Uh-huh. It's not something that, like, personally, I'm gonna binge watch like mm-hmm. all of them.
It's before your time.
Yeah, it's a little before my time, but I still enjoy it. It's like one of those shows that, like, you turn the lights off, you grab a snack, you put your feet up, and like you watch an episode, and it makes you feel good before you go to bed.
Well, actually, it's fascinating how much storytelling they're able to do in a half an hour, actually 22 minutes. You know, I mean,
it's actually kind of crazy. The stories have how efficient they are.
They move along really
fast.
The
stories have a beginning, middle, and end, and they're only like 22 minutes. But they have a whole situation. They get it across. There's a zillion things they could do. They do the simplest thing. But like again, as long as you have like, I mean, when you're dealing with Rick Dalton and James Coburn, or Rick Dalton and Vic Morrow, I mean, it's going to be fucking great. Herbie has some of his different episodes. He has the names of them. I remember my favorite ones, though. One of them, a favorite one, is called Stage Bound for Tucson. And it's Darren McGavin is the guest.
Oh, I love Darren McGavin.
He's fucking great on these. You know, he's great on any of these shows that he shows up on. He's like, he's the man. And Jay Cahill has got a guy named Big Bill Shelley. He's got an outlaw that he's bringing in. They're on the Stage Bound for Tucson. And also on the stage is the legendary gunfighter Tom Horn, played by Darren McGavin.
Yeah.
And so...
Not played by Steve McQueen.
Not played by Steve McQueen. Before Steve McQueen played him, he was a character in this. And so at first they come across like they're going to be friendly. Jay Cahill totally knows who Tom Horn is. But then at some point, Tom Horn ends up killing Jake's prisoner.
Ooh.
And he's like... Okay, but it's okay. He's wanted dead or alive. Okay, we're going to split the bounty when we get to Tucson. And then Jake's like, we're not going to split the bounty. It's my bounty. I'm the one that caught him.
Yeah, just because you shot him dead doesn't mean that we're splitting.
And he goes, okay, but look, I'm going to tell the Tucson sheriff that we're partners in there. Who do you think he's going to believe? Well, he's going to believe me. Okay, let me explain something to you. I don't know what you think about Apaches. But I can tell you what people of Tucson think of Apaches. They don't like them. And I'm the guy who caught Geronimo. So who do you think they're going to believe? You or me? Tom Horn ends up winning. But then there's like a nice twist at the very, very end, at the tag, at the epilogue tag. There's a nice twist, which I won't reveal.
Okay.
In case you get a chance to see the episode, but it's a real funny twist at the end. But then there's also a really, really good one that was it's like a two-parter, and it was directed by Joseph H. Lewis, who directed Gun Crazy.
Okay, yeah.
And it's called Incident in
Park. Gun Crazy is great.
Yeah.
Super visual.
He's a terrific director. He also did a lot of really good Riflemans. He did a lot of really good Riflemans
as well. Was he a TV director before he did Gun Crazy? Like
No, there wasn't TV when he did Gun Crazy. Right. He's a B-movie director. No, he was a B-movie director. But you're right, though. Literally doing movie serials, which would be the equivalent of a TV show. So he started off doing like East Side Kids.
Right.
And, like a Charlie Chan. But he did an episode called Incident in Parkertown. Mm-hmm. And it's about a black municipality. It's like a town that's basically just, it's a black town. And Jake comes in and he knows the sheriff. The sheriff's played by Sammy Davis Jr. Mm-hmm. And they've captured this like really dangerous white bank robber played by Vic Morrow.
Yeah.
But they got to get him out of this town before his gang comes in and tears the town apart. So they have to make up a little posse made up of some of the black residents of the town, and they asked Jake to go along with them. But one of the posse members she did two dramatic TV roles. This is one of two she did. Dorothy Dandridge, the black actress Dorothy Dandridge. And she did this episode of Incident in Parkertown. And that's got a surprise ending at the end of it. It's a really fun episode. And it's a two-parter too. So before we get into talking about Manhunter, there's this part in the Gomez book that I really like this because it made me think it's a nice thing about Rick and his career and just Rick and his life and stuff. It's talking about after the whole flamethrower incident at the house, he was invited on The Tonight Show. Dalton made his first appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 71. Rick proved a big hit in Johnny's chair. Both Johnny and the audience liked him. Johnny always had a slight deference to people who were stars before he was. Turns out Johnny was a Bounty Law fan. And Carson had him back whenever he had something to promote. And soon, Dalton could be seen sitting behind a desk surrounded by Paul Lynn, Wally Cox, and Charlie Weaver on the Hollywood Squares, playing guessing games on Password and the $20,000 Pyramid, bowling spares on Celebrity Bowling, horsing around and filling in blanks with Richard Dawson, Brett Summers, and Charles Nelson Reilly on Match Game, and acting cute with the other Hollywood couples on Burt Convy's Tattletales, where Francesca, with her ditzy Italian shtick, was a big hit. And for the rest of the decade, Rick could be seen on the couch of Mike, Merv, and Diana, yucking it up with Henry Winkler, Ben Vereen, Joe Namath, Brenda Vaccaro, and Nanette Fabre. The end result of all this horsing around was, to a large degree, Rick Dalton enjoying his Hollywood career in a way he never had up until then. He could still get movies from time to time, but he knew he'd never be a movie star. He'd never do as good as McQueen or Burt. Frankly, he'd be happy to do as good as William Shatner or Robert Culp, both actors who were serious draws on TV movies, as Burt and Steve were in theatrical films. But with that realization came an inner peace that had eluded Rick his whole career. But not just a feeling of inner peace, but a sense of humor about himself that was completely absent in the first half of his career. And you can see it when he flirts with Diana, or teases Merv, or just plain has fun on Match Game and Tattletales. Rick was finally having fun being a TV star. And that's a nice little story, I think, about him.
The Manhunter, starring Rick Dalton, with guest stars Harry Gardino, William Watson, Bo Hopkins, William Shallard. Tonight's episode, Death on the Run.
So the second film that we watched is his TV movie pilot for his second series, which was a Quinn Martin series, called Manhunter. And the movie stars Rick, who's the star, Gary Lockwood, Stephanie Powers, a magnificent James Olsen, and
and Tim O'Connor.
And Tim O'Connor,
From Battlestar Galactica. I love Tim O'Connor. Yeah. You know I love Tim O'Connor.
And he's very good in the show.
I was so excited when he showed up. No, and he's on Battlestar Galactica. It's actually Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers. Yeah, that's what he is. Buck Rogers. And let me read, this is from the back of the Manhunter box. An ex-Marine returns home from China in 1933 and is challenged to search for a notorious gang of bank robbers and killers. Headed by his sister. this is not me reading it badly.
Yeah, it's just badly written.
Hardened by his experiences in battles abroad and with a vengeance to uphold the law, this manhunter, played by Rick Dalton, wages a new kind of war at home. Gary Lockwood and Stephanie Powers, of Heart to Heart fame, also headline the cast in this stylish period detective drama. Lockwood and Powers play a pair of romantic but ruthless Bonnie and Clyde-type crooks who, with their accomplices, clean out banks and manage to evade the police. Dalton must use all his war-taught resources along with reminiscences from his sister's ways to track the cunning gangsters. This has nothing. There's no sister.
No, he doesn't. Doesn't he have a sister?
No, but not a sister who's a famous bank robber.
They're making it up. An AI wrote that.
It's someone who never saw that.
Yeah. The getaway chases are fast, fun, and furious in this rollicking adventure movie from worldwide home video.
Well, it is rollicking.
It is.
It has a great
and
rollick
it is fast
to it.
And furious.
Yeah.
And it is fast and furious. It's got a great cast.
Well, it's got Gary Lockwood in it, and I love Gary Lockwood.
I love
even
Gary Lockwood.
This is later Gary Lockwood.
I like this slightly gone to seed Gary Lockwood.
Yeah, I like him slightly gone to seed, and he and Rick are kind of cool. Like,
By Manhunter, part of the thing that's defined about Rick is he's about like 20 to 15 pounds heavier than he was, in his younger movie days. But he looks good that way, actually. He looks good that way. He doesn't look quite as gone to seed as Gary Lockwood does, but they're still in the cool zone together. You can imagine Rick playing the Gary Lockwood part if he wasn't the star of the series.
Oh, no, actually, That's actually totally what I was thinking, is that that part was good enough for Rick. I like it when Rick first shows up, that he's wearing like that World War One uniform, and he looks really cool in it.
He looks really slick in it.
He actually, by the way,
that's a great shot, that first crane shot. All right, where the gangsters are leaving, and it goes down to the bus, and you see Rick in the window of the bus in his uniform.
Yeah, like, it's like the camera's moving, and the bus is moving, and it does like a close-up in the bus, it cranes up or something.
Yeah, when you see the gangsters leave the gas station, just as the bus comes pulling in. He's pulling in as the bad guys
leaving out.
It's a
really good, compelling episode also, because
it's a great storyline.
It could stand alone as a movie, and like, you could tell me there was no TV show and I'd be 100% satisfied with this episode as a movie.
And he's also,
if the action scenes were more bloody and more like balls to the wall, it would be terrific.
And it's also kind of in his wheelhouse, though he's not a bounty hunter. He's a manhunter. He's
a bounty hunter. He's being bounty. You call it a reward, but he's still making a lot of money. He's doing it for money.
I guess it is about, because he goes into the post office all the time and he's pulling off the
those are handbills. Those are handbills he's taking.
Yeah, that's right. I'm gonna get this guy next.
Quentin, you told a really nice story when we were watching this about how Rick chose to play this straight, and about how when you're a lead actor on a show, you want to let your guest stars be. I loved that story.
Yeah, well, it was really interesting because Quinn Martin, I mean, Rick was very, very excited to be like doing a show produced by Quinn Martin, who was one of the biggest producers in town. And he had acted in guest roles in different Quinn Martin shows. And one of them that he acted in was a really good episode of the Burt Reynolds show, Dan August, The Law.
Oh, yeah.
Rick and Burt had worked together like on Riverboat before, and they'd done a few things together. So now they're doing this episode of Dan August. And so in between the show, he's talking to Burt, and he's watching how Burt's playing the role, and he's not playing it the way Burt Reynolds normally played stuff. He's very cut and dried. Very kind of, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And he's doing it in kind of this hip way, but he's not charming it up the way you imagine Burt doing it. Rick asked him, he goes, why are you playing the character so dry? I normally think of you as a personality first actor. And then Burt Reynolds, because that's what Quinn Martin wants. I mean, he doesn't want his leads horsing around on his show. He doesn't want you being cute. He doesn't want you having big trademarks or anything. You're the lead. He wants you to basically do it like Ephraim Zimbalist fucking Jr. That's the way you do it. Now, the guest stars, they're the ones that have the fireworks. They're the ones that get to do this and get to do that. All the bad guys, they're the ones that have the good parts.
That's how you lure the guests to come on the show. You're like, you're giving them a really good, juicy role. That's how you get Gary Lockwood.
Absolutely. So when Rick starts doing Manhunter, he realized how right Burt was. He's got a very good role in this. But everyone else gets to do all the fireworks. He's just got to be the strong, tough,
He still gets a lot of mileage out of that brooding kind of...
he gets a lot of mileage out of his cowboy experience. He makes it really feel like Glenn Ford does to some degree in Cades County. He makes it feel like a modern-day Western because of his cowboy swagger.
Okay, I hit it when it happened. When the bank robbery happens and the gun goes off and his dog is killed. And
his childhood sweetheart.
Who's married the other guy.
Yeah, married the
while he was away at war.
The doofus sheriff,
Yeah, while he was away at war. I cried in that moment.
Uh-huh. Oh, I did too.
They played that so well, and he played that so well. He went deeper stoic. It's like he hardened.
Well, you guys loved the scene with him and Tim O'Connor, where he's like, this is my...
Tim O'Connor's amazing in this. Tim O'Connor is hilarious in this.
Yeah, but the big monologue that Rick has.
That's the scene, because it's like, it goes... Like, it does exactly what you think it's going to do.
When he's grabbing Tim O'Connor, and he's like, oh, you want to know why I did this? This is why I did it! Yeah, is it my dead dog? This is why I did it. Sweetheart. This is why I did it.
The best part about
it. He doesn't care so much. He just lost money.
That's the best part about it, is that it starts off with the dead sweetheart, and then it kind of goes to like these other people that you don't think that he would like.
they lost their money.
It's the dead sweetheart. It's the cop that's shot. And then all of a sudden it's like, he just lost some money. They're going to have nightmares. Yeah. And then he takes him, and then he shows the dog, and he punctuates
this with
the dog.
This is my dog. It was a good dog.
Yeah, it's a good
dog. And it was a good dog. Now, the first thing we said when we saw that dog was, wow, that's a really good dog.
And it ripped my heart out when that happened. Mm. And that's, by the way, pre-John Wick.
Yeah.
You know, everybody talked about John Wick and how, you know, like, one thing you don't do is kill a man's dog. That's his motivation. Yeah. They killed his dog. Well, Manhunter did it first.
Yeah, absolutely.
and Rick did it first.
And then it has that whole middle section because, I'm telling you, we do awards, all right? Obviously, I think Rick's going to win Best Actor, but I think James Olsen wins Best Supporting Actor, all right? James
as the disgruntled second criminal underneath Gary Lockwood, who's jealous of all the newspaper print that Gary Lockwood is getting.
And I don't like James Olsen, but he's... kills it in this fucking movie.
So funny.
Just the image of him with his hands out the window of the car. Yeah.
Oh, it's just like...
The indignities never end for him.
Indignities never end for him. It's just, it's almost too humiliating a role to play. Yeah. All right? And he just commits to it 100%. And then also, it's also kind of funny because, okay, so there's all these like subtleties in there. Like, okay, so for one, not only is it driving James Olsen crazy...
to be second fiddle.
Yeah, that, you know, Frank, all right, Gary Lockwood's character, what is like such the boss of him, all right, that his wife, all right, his sister is like, seems has a love affair going on with her brother. All right. But then it's actually shown that Frank is, he's almost like a simple-minded child, all right? He's just...
He loves his horse.
Yeah, he's just, you know, he's got a childlike mind, but he's a violent child. Yeah. So he's almost like Billy Mummy, all right, in the Twilight Zone episode. Everyone has to placate his childish, murderous rages. And if you placate his childish, murderous rages, then you maybe get along. And that's why Stephanie Powers handles him so well. But then it's like James Olsen has to hear, oh, no, he's the mastermind.
He's not a mastermind. And then he's reading the article and he's like, they say he's like, you know, a masterful with a Tommy gun. I know how to shoot a Tommy gun.
And he's the,
and the
one
way
actually...
he executes his minions.
Yeah, they called him a minion. That was the...
his execution of his minions.
And he's the one that actually is holding it all together.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, I think there was a script change made at one point. I think the dog getting killed.
Yeah.
Because of Gary Lockwood's love of horses, like how obsessed he is with horses, how what gives him away is that he goes shopping for a bridle
and
a saddle for the horses. That's the device that allows them to eventually find him. And because he loves horses so much, when Rick first comes riding into town, he's riding on a horse and he's got his dog with him.
Yeah.
He gets off and he goes in and then the bank robbery happens and the dog gets killed and everything. Somehow, I bet in the original script, it was his horse that got shot somehow.
Oh, maybe you might be right about that.
And that Gary Lockwood, because afterwards he's like, I didn't mean to shoot his dog. Like he's really upset that this accident happened during their bank robbery.
Yeah.
And that actually really choked me up.
Yeah,
the fact that this kind of criminal guy was so broken up over what happened. He's like,
I didn't mean to shoot that dog. I didn't mean to shoot that dog.
I didn't mean it to happen. Like he's really upset about it. Yeah. And I was thinking, if had that been a horse, it would have been even worse for him.
And so I'll bet that
it was just impossible to stage or whatever.
Also, that horse in the very end, that slow-mo sequence is so good with the horse and he's jumping on bareback and the stunt that happens.
Well, no,
it's fantastic.
The movie is definitely made in the wake of Bonnie and Clyde and John Milius's Dillinger.
And it does a really good job capturing Depression-era America.
Oh, it does a really good job.
It's a very A++ on all the cars, all those cool cars.
The production design of all the whatever little small little California towns they went to shoot it, you know, they're like a block or two blocks long or like they're exquisite. I've seen some recent movies recently that like fell apart when it came to stuff like this. This thing puts them all to shame. And you know, but it's definitely jumping off from those kind of movies. Look, it doesn't have the punchy dialogue, as good as the dialogue is. It doesn't have the punchy dialogue of a John Milius or a Benton and Newman or forget about Robert Towne. You know, but it does have a slow motion. It does have slow motion deaths.
The only thing
the movie needs is like just bursting blood squibs. I mean, this is the only thing it needs 70 movie violent action.
And if it hadn't have been a TV movie,
It would have had it. No, it needs a Roaring Thunder level of shit done with a Tommy gun.
Now, Quinn Martin would probably be making these in California, but it doesn't look like California to me. It looks like somewhere.
Well, they could have. I'm sure, especially back then. I'm sure. Yeah, you go up.
Because I've scouted all these little towns like you have.
You go up to King
here.
California. You go up to Lone Pine. Yeah. You go up to this place. You go up to that place.
This movie's available on YouTube in case anyone wants to watch it. I picked up a VHS of this for $5.69. It's a copy from Good Time. So I'm gonna have some good times with that one.
Okay, so let me just read the what ended up happening with the show. Okay, I'll just pick this up from here. Rick found out what Burt Reynolds told him about starring in a Quentin Martin show was right on. Almost everyone in the cast got to do more acting than him. Nevertheless, he was on top of the call sheet. He was a good guy, but the good violent guy. Rick liked that. It was his show, and when there was a fight, he won them. Then the TV movie aired, and it did pretty well. It didn't beat the ABC Wednesday night movie of the week, which that Wednesday was Gloria Swanson making her television debut in the horror film The Killer Bees. But both CBS and Quinn Martin were happy enough with the results to make a full 22-episode commitment to the next season's fall schedule. So a very happy Rick Dalton spent the rest of 74 and the beginning of 75 shooting his series. Rick spent the last season of Bounty Law desperately trying to get off it. Then he spent the last 8 years kicking himself in the ass for his arrogance. Dalton truly imagined there wasn't a chance of him ever landing another series on his own ever again. So despite him being on the cover of TV Guide twice for Bounty Law, and even his inside story about the flamethrower incident in 69, when he was in the fall preview issue of TV Guide for the 74-75 television season with a new series starring him, Rick felt something that it took him many years in the business to feel. Grateful. Rick Dalton was back. The series followed the same template as the TV movie pilot. Rick Dalton is 30s bounty hunter David Barrett chasing after 30s gangster characters that were surrogates for famous real-life 30s gangsters. The first episode of the series saw him going after a Ma Barker-like gang called the Ma Gantry Gang, with High Sierra star Ida Lupino playing Ma and Sam Elliott and Don Stroud recreating his role from Roger Corman's Ma Barker epic Bloody Mama as her two killer sons. In another episode, babyface Michael Burns would play a babyface Nelson type. In another, Bo Hopkins and 70s sleazebag William Watson would recreate the Kansas City Massacre. 1 year before Bo Hopkins would play Pretty Boy Floyd in Dan Curtis's TV movie about the same subject. And in an episode reminiscent of Rick's Cades County segment, Legs Diamond star Ray Danton would star in a chapter titled The Man Who Thought He Was Dillinger. Befitting a Quinn Martin series, it had a cornucopia of big-name guest stars. Bradford Dillman, Robert Loggia, Tom Skerritt, Leslie Nielsen, Robert Foxworth, Celeste Holmes, Shirley Knight, Kevin McCarthy, and Woody Strode. And it even reunited Dalton with some actors from his past. Kaz Garris from the 14th Fist of McCluskey, the Green Hornet's Van Williams showed up for the show, and Joan Van Ark, his co-star on Rick's Night Gallery, did an episode. And Leslie H. Martinson, who directed him in the Stuart Granger African-helmed picture Big Game, helmed a couple episodes. Even Pete Dool's brother Jeffrey made an appearance. It went on the air September 11th, 1974, at the start of the fall season. Wednesday was its night of the week on CBS, at 10 o'clock, right after William Conrad on Cannon. It aired opposite two other new series on the other channels. Teresa Graves' Get Christy Love on ABC, which is what I would have been watching, and Barry Newman's Petrocelli on NBC. Manhunter was a damn good show, one of Quinn Martin's best, but it lasted only one season. CBS gave it the axe for three big reasons. One, it never beat its rival show, Petrocelli, over on the Peacock Network. Two, it never sufficiently held on to its lead-in show, Cannon's audience. But three, and the main reason, was the show was highly criticized for its level of violence. It was easily the most violent show on CBS, even beating out Mike Connors on Mannix. To get anywhere near as violent, you had to flip over to ABC and watch SWAT. Because of all the gangsters shooting Tommy guns and the methods Dalton's Dan Barrett would use to trap his quarry, sawed-off shotguns, dynamite, bear traps, Manhunter seemed more violent. Then add to the fact that the lead wasn't even a real cop. Manhunter was one badass show. It lasted its original 22 episodes, but it never went to repeats. CBS instead aired reruns of Burt Reynolds' old show, Dan August. However, this time, nobody blamed Rick. He was dynamic in the role, he was professional to work with, and as the series lead, he set a good example for the cast and crew. And most importantly, Quinn Martin had nothing but good things to say about him. Rick's agent told him the networks were looking for another series to plug him into. And that series became the Australian show Dingo Dan, where Rick played a truck driver from Texas in Australia known as Truckies, and who with his pet Dingo Marsha, just rode from place to place and got into adventures. It was on for 3 seasons in Australia, though it never got a syndicated in the States. Okay, so now I'm going to read part two of my Q&A done in 1999 with Rick Dalton. I'll pick it up right where we left off before. This is me talking. Another underrated action director you worked a lot with was Paul Wenkos. My favorite of all my directors, and director of the best movie I ever made, 14 Fist of McCluskey. How would you describe the difference between Whitney and Wenkos? Well, good question, Quentin. The biggest difference between the two was their style. The biggest similarity was their method. Both men knew what they were doing. They knew how to shoot. They knew how to run a set. They knew how to get the best out of their people. They knew how to block a scene, stage a scene, and they knew how to get their day done. Besides Paul's ability, the most impressive thing about Paul was he looked like a director. He was an impressive cat, and he inspired confidence. By comparison, Bill looked like a pile of dirty laundry. Also, Paul was more what you'd call an actor's director. So Battle of the Coral Sea was the first film you did together. I worked for him in a one-line bit in a film he did for Columbia with Darren McGavin called The Case Against Brooklyn. If I remember correctly, there was a pretty good part in that flick that I read for. I didn't get it. Brian Hutton got it. He later became a director. Yeah, he directed Where Eagles Dare and Kelly's Heroes. Right. But even though I didn't get it, Paul dug me. So when he was doing Gidget, he brings me in for one of James Darren's surfer buddies. And I almost get it. But at the last minute, Tommy Laughlin comes in and wins the role. So when Battle of the Coral Sea comes along, third time's a charm. And both me and Tommy land parts. Think about that movie, even though the story was fabricated, it was based on a real incident of prisoners escaping from a Japanese POW camp and how they pulled off the escape. Later, when I started doing Bounty Law, I get a stunt double named Cliff Booth, and he became my stunt double from that point on. And as time wore on, my best friend. Later, we wrote The Fireman together, and he directed the action scenes and directed the two sequels. Anywho, Cliff was one of the most decorated heroes of World War II. I mean, Audie Murphy and Neville Brand level of hero. And it turns out the Battle of the Coral Sea was based on his escape from a Japanese prisoner of war camp in the Philippines.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That's true.
You bet. So when I get Bounty Law, both Paul and Bill directed episodes. And I have to say, it made me feel really good whenever they did a show because I could tell both of them were really proud of me. Well, how did it work out you got the 14 Fist of McCluskey? Sure luck. I was under contract at Universal Pictures at the time. And Paul was doing McCluskey for Columbia Pictures. And fucking Fabian had my part. 10 days before he starts shooting, he breaks his shoulder doing a Virginian, directed by William Whitney, no less. Columbia wants either Bobby Darin or Ed Burns to replace him. But Wenko fights the Columbia brass for me and gets his way. So they borrow me from Universal to do McCluskey. Like, that film really holds up, and it's a true classic of the genre. The best movie I ever made, that's for damn sure. What did you think of the remake Richard Donner did with Mel Gibson? Well, you know, I worked with Dick Donner back in my TV days, you know, a couple of times. And Mel guested it on Dingo Dan the year before he did Mad Max. So I like both men. But frankly, I didn't see the point of remaking it other than, you know, utilizing the popularity of the title. On the other hand, I thought it was pretty groovy to make a film good enough that 30 years later they'd remake it. And to tell you the truth, I'm pretty fucking happy it wasn't a passion of ours. So do you remember when Mel Gibson guested on Dingo Dan? Of course I do. George Miller directed the episode. George Miller? No, not that George Miller.
The other one.
Oh, the man from Snowy River, George Miller. Right. You see, back then, Mel, Steve Bisbee, John Jarrett, and a young fellow named Tony Bonner, they were the swinging dicks in Australia. None of them had done the movies they were later to be known for yet. But all four of them had done a small Aussie film together called Summer City. And the year after doing my show is when they all did the movies that broke them in Sydney. Have you seen Mel Gibson since? Not in the last 25 years, but we saw each other a couple of times after he did Mad Max. In fact, we almost starred in a picture together. It was another World War II movie like McCluskey. Oh, Attack Force Z? Oh, yeah, the part that John Philip Law played. I think that's what it was called. I never saw it. How come you didn't do it? That would have been cool. I can't remember. Something got in the way. You mentioned Tom Laughlin, better known as Billy Jack, and I'm a big fan of both Billy Jack and Tom Laughlin. You worked with him in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and he was two of the fists in the 14 Fists of McCluskey. And he did a battle law. So I take it you two were friends? You bet. He got me cast in the only legit theater production I ever did. It was a play called Fragile Fox. Oh, the play that Robert Aldrich's Attack was based on? Right again. Man, Q, you sure know your stuff. Tommy played the Jack Palance role, and I played the part William Smithers played. Holy shit, I would have loved to have seen that. Well, my guess is you were probably 2 years old at the time. Well, probably. What did you think of Billy Jack? Sensational. Tom was wonderful in that flick. The scene in the ice cream parlor is one of the great badass action scenes of all time. Well, I ain't seen it since it came out. What's the ice cream parlor scene? Well, the famous scene where Billy Jack gives that little speech before he fucks those rednecks up. Bernard, Gene and all the other kids at the Freedom School always tell me I need to learn how to control my violent temper and be pacifist and nonviolent like they are. And I try, Bernard. I really do. I try. I really try. I really, really, really try. I do. I do. I do. But when I see what you do to a little girl we find so precious that we call her God's little ray of sunshine, and when I think of the years of pain and humiliation that this idiotic act of yours will cause, it just makes me go berserk. And then he beats up everybody.
Kicks ass.
And then Rick said, not a bad Tom. Well, I've been doing it since I was 12. Well, you see, Tommy was very enamored of Brando. And while he knew he wasn't as good as Brando, he felt he was better than McQueen. And Billy Jack was his way to prove it. Did he ever talk to you about being in Billy Jack? Yes, actually. I think I almost played the sheriff with the hippie daughter. Holy shit! You almost played the Kenneth Toby role? Yeah, that's who I think did. That would have been fucking awesome. Why didn't you do it? I don't know. It just didn't work out. I can't remember why. Well, after such a tremendous success as Billy Jack, you'd think Tom Laughlin would have carte blanche in this town for the rest of his life. I mean, why do you think he didn't do better after the first two Billy Jack movies? Well, of all the people I ever met in this business, nobody, and I mean nobody, had a bigger hate-on for the studios than Tommy Laughlin. And the studios, they hated him right back. Tom was going to show Hollywood how it should be done. And then, God bless him, he fucking did it. He beat him at their own fucking game. He embarrassed the shit out of Warner Brothers. But Hollywood is a company town. You don't make friends in Detroit by embarrassing the Ford Motor Company. And you don't make friends in Hollywood by making Warners look like buffoons and then bragging about it to the press. Still, I'm surprised he didn't at least get a few acting offers at the studio level. That wasn't Tom's bag. He didn't want to just appear in movies. He wanted those movies to be his movies. I'm sure he got a few acting offers, but knowing Tom, he probably told him to fuck off. In fact, after all the shit he said about Warner Brothers, I think they came back to him and offered him the John Saxon role in Enter the Dragon. And if he had said yes to that, and then it goes out and does what it did, nobody could have denied him. But making dumbass action movies for the studios wasn't what Tom was about. Tom wasn't just another swinging dick. Tom had vision. If he couldn't work his way, he'd rather not work, so he didn't.
The Video Archives podcast will return in 2 weeks for part 2 of Day of the Dalton, our celebration of the life and works of actor Rick Dalton. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a great night. The Video Archives podcast is hosted by Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery, and produced by Josh Richmond and Gala Avery, with executive producers Colin Anderson and Natalie Mualem. Our engineers are Alex Gonzalez and Casey Holford. Find out more about the show and get Video Archives merch at videoarchivespodcast.com. You can also find us on Twitter @VideoArchives and on Instagram @VideoArchivesPod.